Good morning, everybody. Wonderful to see you, even when if I can only see a half inch of you two-dimensionally. And some of you, I can only see your names, and then it's surrounded by darkness. Oh, that must be the true Zen way. Anyway, it's great to be with you, even if we're only two-dimensional. This morning I'm going to talk about a phrase from the early 20th century ballet dancer, most famous early 20th century ballet dancer who died in 1950, Vaslav Nijinsky. So he was asked how he did it. What was the secret? What were the techniques? What made it work for him? He said, "It's really quite simple. I merely leap and pause, leap and pause." So, pausing and leaping and dancing in poetry, in Zen practice and life. To really pause, to completely still the body and mind for even a moment, it's difficult. Even for me this morning, it was difficult. I wanted to check, you know, usually at Zen Center, I can see everyone. But I said, oh, there are more people coming in. I need to go check and see who's there. So, but Tim, just come back. Just pause. Without the pause, the leap loses its connection with reality, with the world. It loses its rootedness. And it becomes based on impulse if we just leap. George W. Bush leapt into that Iraq war. He said, "I trust my gut. I leap into that war." Ah, and we're still suffering from that. We're not suffering so much of it as the Middle Eastern people are, the Iraqis in particular, but also it destabilized the whole Middle East. In the 60s, and I came of age, so to speak, in the 60s, although I don't know, maybe I'm still coming of age, but anyway, supposedly I came of age in the 60s. We had the Vietnam War, which was a racist war. That was a racist war. No doubt about it. And I protested that war, and I was a good Zen student, so I did it quietly, and I tried to breathe, but I've told you guys before that once Hubert Humphrey, who was the apologist for Lyndon Johnson, came to my campus, Stanford campus, and started justifying and spent his whole time in his speech justifying the war, and my anger got bigger and bigger and bigger. And pretty soon, at the end, I didn't even know what happened, but I found myself in a crowd chasing Hubert Humphrey. When I came to Minnesota, I realized what a bodhisattva Hubert Humphrey had been in many other ways. But Johnson was, you know, really, really made him into his lap boy. So there I was chasing him. And I still talk about it. I still feel a little embarrassed because I was doing Zen practice. I had sat that morning. But I had not really learned how to pause in my sitting. It takes a while to really get this in you so you can pause. And of course, as we practice our sitting, we're pausing and our difficulties are coming in. So we're pausing with our difficulties. And we have a lot of difficulties culturally right now. First, we have the pandemic. Second, we have the awful killing of George Floyd. Then we have the police coming down and many of them hurting the protesters. And then we have other police saying, well, I'm just trying to help. And you're blaming me when I'm just trying to help. So we get really confused sitting with all these. But we're learning how to pause. We're learning how to pause with just whatever is. And if we do that, we realize that regardless of how stressed we are, there's an ebb and a flow to our anxiety. There's an ebb and a flow to our depression, to our agitation. It ebbs and flows because guess what? Everything is changing. Anybody ever tell you that before? So it's all, even if we feel that we're frozen in depression or discouragement, everything is ebbing and flowing. Is it possible to match the ebbing and flowing of our feeling with the ebbing and flowing of our breath, even if it's anxiety? Can we just match them? Just be there with them together? If we can, we begin to settle in just to being where we are, wherever we are, there we are. So our training starts on the cushion. We train with whatever arises. And what generally arises, not always, but often arises, is difficulty. And difficulties then become the path. Difficulties actually are the path, even if they aren't always arising in your life. Just keep sitting for a while longer and difficulty will come up. Just keep sitting. Difficulties are the path. But there's an opportunity also to open ourselves to deeper and deeper kind of awareness and calmness right here. But the awareness doesn't feel calm, but if we stay with it, we experience a calmness that envelops it, that encases it. Instead of acting impulsively, just pause. So after I chased Hubert Humphrey, and luckily we didn't get far because the Secret Service were there. I wonder what we would have done if we'd caught him. But there was a whole phalanx of Secret Service. And I didn't even know anything about him. I didn't know he did all these things to help people. I wasn't from Minnesota. But later I found out, my aunt said, my aunt who lived in northern Minnesota for years and was a follower of the Catholic worker, Dorothy Day, she said, "You really chased him? He's a good man." I said, "Well, I'm sorry, Alma. It didn't sound good to me when he was talking about that war and those people were all getting killed that we don't even know who live over there. We're part of the fabric of our being." So after I'd paused for 3 or 4 months and been at Zen Monastery for a while, or for 3 months, 4 months, I was ready to go back and do another peace demonstration. I did it with my wife. And this time, it was pretty cool. It was pretty wonderful. It was pretty wonderful. Pretty wonderful. My wife once said that we met at a peace march, which we did, and she thought we might die at one. But I don't know. She doesn't go on them anymore, so I don't think we can die at them. So another time I had to pause that I've talked about before a lot, so I won't spend much time on it, is after my brother's suicide. I was at Zen Center and I was very confused. I felt very guilty. He'd hung himself from a sheet in a locked ward in a mental hospital. And he had chemical dependency and mental illness, and I felt incredibly guilty. So I just came inside every morning. I already was sitting every morning at Zen Center. And lots of times I didn't even want to stay and sit. I wanted to run home and just go on my bed. But I just did it. I just did it. And Katagiri Roshi, there were a few of us who did it in the morning. About the same amount as do it now, actually. Well, maybe a half dozen at best. We sat. And Katagiri Roshi was always there. And he never said anything, but just his presence helped me a lot. Just his presence. And so I paused for, like, with confusion for maybe, I don't know, a year, maybe give or take a few months, not knowing what to do, feeling confused, feeling upset, even not knowing if I should even stay with meditation, because when my meditation, I just had felt wounded the whole time. But I just breathed into it with some kind of faith. I don't know where it came from. I think from Katagiri's presence and from the memory of my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, and his presence. I don't know. But then at some point, I was ready to leap. At some point, I calmed down. My sadness was still there. My grieving was still there, but I was ready to do something. I was already a human service professional. I directed an agency already. So I was ready to leap and try to create venues in the community for people like my brother, so they didn't have to be pushed away into locked wards. And that's what I spent the next 25 years doing. Something like the next 25 years. Something like that. So with the best poetry too, the writer spends time reflecting before she leaps. So she may leap and pause and leap and pause and leap. Oh, well, not exactly that way. Maybe it can be leaping first. My friend Paul, who's a poet, he leaps first. He puts something down on paper. Then he pauses in a very meditative way. He does zazen and he pauses meditatively. He breathes meditatively. And only when he's really paused again is he ready to leap. Then he pauses and he leaps. Pausing doesn't make us sure about what we're doing. It doesn't. But we do develop a quiet confidence. A quiet confidence. And pausing is the only really good preparation for leaping. But at some point we have to leap. We just have to leap. Here's what Agnes DeMille says. Living is a form of not being sure, not knowing what next or how. The moment you know how, you begin to die a little. The artist and poet never entirely knows. We guess. We may be wrong, but we take leap after leap in the dark. So now I'm going to talk about three poems by three poets. And I didn't mean to choose poets who lived in times of social unrest, but if you look at all of our major poets, East and West, most of them lived in times of major social unrest. I was looking for some who didn't. I found a couple, but most did. Most did. So I'm first going to talk about Basho, who lived in the 17th century in Japan. I've talked about before. Then I'm not going to talk about them. I'm just going to give a poem by each of them. Then a poem by Garcia Lorca, who lived during the Spanish Civil War. Then I'm going to finish with Allen Ginsberg, who was one of the kind of early 60s people who really protested against the Vietnamese War. And was a Buddhist, by the way. It was a Buddhist. So let's see. I'm going to try to do what Jeremy trained me to do, which is show you the first picture and then talk about it. So let's see, I'm going to press share screen. Then I'm going to, try to find this poem. It's not coming on. Well, I had it on. I may just have to show it. I just may have to do it without showing it to you, Jeremy, can you hear me?
I can.
Can you give me instruction?
We can.
Okay, good. Good. Excellent. So everybody can see it. Okay, so the first poem, Basho, 17th century. I can only see six of you, but can you see it? Jeremy can see it. Okay. Basho, 17th century. In plum blossom scent, pop, sun appears, mountain path. So Basho, main practice was to do walking meditation. He lived in a Zen monastery for a while, but he did walking meditation. He walked as a poet teacher. He walked and walked and walked. And his disciples sometimes would walk with him. So we can imagine him walking at the base, probably of Mount Fuji. And it's very, very misty. It's so misty he can't see anything. But he's settling in, he's pausing, he's being with his steps, and all of a sudden he's immersed in plum blossoms. He's just smelling the aroma of plum blossoms, even though he can't see anything. So that's his one-pointed enjoyment of the plum blossoms. And then, pop, the sun appears, and there's a mountain path. So some teachers consider this an enlightenment poem. First, he's doing his pausing, and then all of a sudden his mind gets very still because he smells the plum blossoms. He's not caught by before and after. And then, pop, everything opens, the sun appears, and he sees the mountain path. So that's one way of talking about that poem. And now I want to come back to you. So maybe, yes, come back to you. So we could say this is an enlightenment poem, but it's also about enlightened activity, because the mountain path is what he has to do now. And the whole thing starts with his activity of stumbling at the base of the mountain and then walking along. So it's all activity in pursuit of enlightenment, which for Dogen is not different than enlightenment activity. And you can see the pause in plum blossom scent, pause, pop, the sun appears, leap, mountain path, leap. So how might we, all of us, walk peacefully on this path when our foundation seems to be constantly crumbling? In case you haven't noticed that, and I know you have, I know we've all noticed that, our foundation is really crumbling. The virus, George Floyd's death, the looting and burning, the ongoing police violence. And we have an urge to freeze. We have an urge to freeze or fight back or to run. Well, last week, Ted was talking about just holding the baby. Yes, can we just hold the baby? The baby of anxiety, the baby of fear. Just hold that baby. When Ted was talking last week about holding the baby, that's pausing, isn't it? We're just holding the baby. Just holding the baby. And it reminded me, as Ted was talking, of how when my mother, I don't know, was she, my father had a 40th birthday party for my mother. And when I was a child, and my mother, and there was a surprise guest who was this tiny little woman, tiny little Mexican immigrant woman who been my mother's nanny, I guess, and grown up with my mother, taught my mother Spanish. And my mother hadn't seen her in years, and Mauricia just appeared out of nowhere. Her name was Mauricia. And gave my mother a huge hug. This woman was about 4'11", 4'10". She came up behind my mother and gave her a huge hug. And my mother felt so supported. She'd never felt supported by her own mother, but Mauricia was the one. She always talked to me about who really supported her, who was a real mother. So we can do this, can't we? We can do this. I think so. Just to support it, just to breathe into it, just to breathe out. To give a broad hug to our fear, our confusion, to be completely present, even relaxing into uncertainty, with chaos swirling around and no place to rest. Discomfort arises not so much from uncertainty, but from our resistance. I hate to say this, but this is a core teaching of Buddha. Stability outside is an illusion. It's an illusion. inside, if we learn to pause, we become experts at pausing and leaping and pausing and leaping, even in times of difficulties. I merely leap and pause. I merely leap and pause. And they asked Nijinsky again for some advice. He said, "That's my only advice. I merely leap and pause." So the best poetry leaps from the known to the unknown. Poetry ties together different strands of being that we don't think are related. But if we see them in the poem, we see how related they are and how everything is related. Lots of times poetry confuses us at first because we don't see the connections. But if we pause, usually we see the connections, and usually, often, we open up to huge interconnectedness. So now I'm going to read a poem. I'm going to try to do this again. I might have to ask Jeremy, so let's see. I'm going to again, there's my word. I'm going to call it up. Oh, it came up. Wow. You can see it? Raise your hand if you can see it. Good. Okay. This is Little Infinite Poem by Garcia Lorca. This is the first stanza by Garcia Lorca. And I've talked about this before, but not in a few years. I prefer it in the Spanish, but my Spanish is not good enough to do it. But I like to read in Spanish anyway, just for the rhythm. Garcia Lorca, who was writing his best poetry and doing his plays during the Spanish Civil War, and he was pretty much non-sectarian, but the autocrats felt very threatened by him, and they were always after him, and he was assassinated at 36 years old, and his body was never found. But before that, he had done beautiful poem and beautiful play after beautiful play. So this one is named Little Infinite Poem. To take the wrong road is to come to the snow. To come to the snow is to get down on all fours for 20 generations and eat the grass of the cemeteries. So lots of times in our life and in our Zen practice and in our meditation, we think we're on the wrong road. Our sitting's not good. We're not treating each other well. But if we just come back to trying our best on this wrong road, is it really wrong? If we think it's the right road, we get attached to it. I've got the right road. But the wrong road, we have to open up more to, because we don't know. We don't know. To take the wrong road, leap, is to come to the snow. Glowing and white, covers everything. Garcia Lorca, what would he mean by that? Sounds like a Buddhist teaching. Leap again, to come to the snow. To come to the snow is to get down on all fours for 20 generations. To get down on all fours for 20 generations. We give ourselves away to all life, having met the snow, which is beautiful translucence covers everything. We give ourselves away to all life, from the distant past to the endless future, for 20 generations, for 30 generations, for 80 generations. And then we leap again. We leap again and eat the grass of the cemeteries. The wonderful nutrition of just full prostration, going all the way down, touching the ground, and eating the grass that's growing out of it. Wonderful nutrition. Reminds me of Katagiri Roshi saying that they went out to gather grass for soup at a heiji when they had no food. And he said the grass soup was very nourishing. I don't know about that, but that's what he said. So on my first book tour, I went back to my home of Palo Alto, California, and I was in the Santa Cruz Mountains, behind Palo Alto. But I think it was before my book reading, and I got lost on a trail. I got on the wrong road. I got on the wrong path. Now, luckily, this is not the kind of lost like in the Sierras or the Rockies, because I could see the city way, way down below. I knew I'd be okay, but I got lost. And so at first I was a little scared, a little kind of disoriented, but then my senses began to open. I really had to pay attention. I was lost. I really had to notice the trees and the twigs and the way the streams went, because I was lost. So pretty wonderful, pretty wonderful. I never got all the way down and ate the grass of the cemeteries. But in a way, I did, because I was able just to be there with everything and enjoy it right in the middle of not knowing. So Franz Kafka, the poet and playwright Franz Kafka, said, "What do I have in common with others? I hardly have anything in common with myself." Many people feel that way. What do we have in common with others? Because we don't even have anything in common with the self. It's always beating ourselves up and being scared and wanting to run and going on and on about the same worries and concerns. But Kafka had not learned how to pause. He didn't have a sitting practice. And Kafka went on and he said, "My thoughts run around like a wild horse, and feelings jump about like a monkey in the forest." So our suffering, produced by horses or monkeys, shatters our sense of wholeness, tears the fabric of interconnectedness. And then we want to aggress against those we identify as other, members of a different race, a different gender, warmongers. We end up decimating the natural world over and over. We humans have been doing that. But there is a mountain path in front of us, and we can do something. There is always a mountain path. But we get caught in this neuromuscular lock of fear, and there's no room to just experience the intimacy of looking at those weeds right in the middle of my lostness. I'd never seen weeds like that, with those beautiful wildflowers growing out of them. To experience intimacy, to pause until the wild horse and the monkey calm way, way down. So I'm going to finish my poems with Allen Ginsberg, and I'm going to pull him up so you can see him. I think you can see him now. Jeremy, would you raise your hand if you can see him? Thank you. Allen Ginsberg. Song. Allen Ginsberg called this poem, he wrote one of his early poems, a song. That's his title of the poem. And in this poem, let me read this poem. "Under the burden of solitude, under the burden of dissatisfaction, the weight we carry is love." Yes, yes, that's what I wanted. I always wanted. I always want to return to the body where I was born. So here are the leaps. Here are the leaps. Under the burden of solitude, under the burden of dissatisfaction, the weight we carry, leap is love. Yes, yes, that's what I wanted. I always wanted. Leap to return to the body where I was born. So he's got his twin burdens of solitude and dissatisfaction. Maybe you have those twin burdens. Solitude from this pandemic and just dissatisfaction with the way we're treating with each other, and especially the members of our minority community that we've oppressed for decade after decade after decade. Suffering under this weight, longing for wholeness. We all have a spiritual yearning to leap to wholeness, to leap to oneness, to leap to heart-mind, to leap to love. And that's his leap. That's his leap. The weight we carry is love. Yes, yes. That's what I wanted. To return to the body where I was born. And in the final lines, there's a repetition of this single affirmative word and rhythmic phrasing. Listen to the rhythmic phrasing, like the beating of the heart. Yes, yes, that's what I wanted. I always wanted. I always wanted to return to the body where I was born. We always want that, don't we? To return to our original wholeness, our original enlightenment, what Dogen calls the body beyond the body, Ginsberg's body of love, the body he longed for. When Dogen wrote The Body Beyond the Body, he had spent several years pausing with his monkey and horse in Zazen, stepping back and reflecting, pausing. And Dogen quoted the Chinese teacher Yashan, although he didn't give Yashan credit. When Yashan was sitting in, and this is in Fukan Zazengi, when Yashan was sitting in meditation, a monk asked, "What do you think about sitting in steadfast composure?" Yashan said, "I think not thinking." The monk said, "How do you think not thinking?" Yashan said, "Non-thinking." When we think non-thinking, we naturally embrace whatever is. If it's anxiety, if it's depression, if it's discouragement, and if it's love, we naturally embrace it. And we hear the cries of the world. The world is crying for us. We need to pause to fully hear those cries so we can leap on that mountain path to help each other, to help people who've been pushed aside, and our own little selves have been pushed aside. But in particular, these days, African Americans, whom we brought to this country, our ancestors brought to this country as slaves, and really we've kept them enslaved ever since. It's just undoubtable. It's undeniable we have. So Basho, Lorca, Ginsberg, they teach us. They teach us. Dogen in the 13th century. Dogen lived at a time in the 13th century in Japan, which was dominated by strife. Buddhist armies forming against each other, activating against each other. And he did Zazen and he gave instructions for pausing, many instructions. Here is a couple of his instructions. Sit Zazen wholeheartedly and let go of all things. Gather together all distracted thought and scattered mind within this posture. Keep your heart and mind from being stirred. And then he implies so we can leap. Then beyond the boundary of delusion and enlightenment, free from the paths of ordinary and sacred, not caught by ordinary thinking, we can wander at ease. We can wander at ease. So pause and leap, separate and not separate. There's aspiration and practice, which is pausing. The practice is pausing. And then, pop, the sun appears, and there's a leap. That's wonderful. And you can call that enlightenment and nirvana, but that sounds like those sound like very fancy words about just cracking open and feeling this wonderful way in which we're already joined to all life. And then Dogen says, yes, there is practice before, there's enlightenment after, but he says, between aspiration, practice, and enlightenment, nirvana, there's not a moment's gap. So where's the pause and where's the leap? It's just a leap pause. It's a pause leap. All moments are whole. They lack nothing. Just this moment right here. Nothing is lacking, despite how we feel. Wei Nung asked a monk, do you depend on practice and enlightenment? The monk replied, it's not that there is no practice and enlightenment. It's just an enlightenment It's just that it's not possible to divide them. Not possible to divide them. And my mother, who was into dance, had me watch a little tape of Nijinsky when I was, I don't know how old I was, 13 or 14. She was probably trying to get me cultured or something. And I couldn't see, thinking back on it, I didn't see any pausing a lot. Leaping. I couldn't see where the leap started and the pause ended, where the pause started and the leap ended. It was just alive. That's our original wholeness, just alive. So Dogen calls this remembering to pause so we can leap completely. Dogen says, when you are fully present, you are free of how broad or narrow it is where you are. Right now, things seem very narrow, very narrow. Literally, because we're two-dimensional, and then socially, because there's so much division and so much pain and so much anger and so much discouragement. But since practice enlightenment are not two, then for Dogen, who's the founder of our school, our understanding is action. All of our understanding is action. Actional understanding, he calls it. So there's no gap between the pause and the leap. If we just pause without leaping, we can't bring alive wholeness. At some point, we'll fully actualize our life. So breathing in, we pause. Breathing out, we leap. But breathing out, we pause. Breathing in, we leap. Breathing in, we leap, pause. Breathing out, we leap, pause. In plum blossom scent, pop, the sun appears. Mountain path.